Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. And they happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, today our special guest is going to be Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who, as you know, had taught at the university level, had worked in the educational division at the during the Reagan administration, testified before Congress, but he's a great researcher. We carry a number of his books through Radio Liberty, and you go to our website again on our get a catalog, and you can look up those we have, and we're hoping to get some of the others back in print here very, very soon. But right now, of course, if you want to get the Dr. Cuddy's writings, you go to newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com, and they have a list of the people who participate on a regular basis. And Dr. Cuddy has a article he puts up there, well, really every week. And they're fascinating, and especially this last one really did appeal to me because, of course, it begins talking about, what's going on in Iraq, what we know is going on in Iraq, and how we can anticipate what is about to happen. And with that as a background, Dr. Cuddy, you picked this story up.
Okay. I'm going to do a little something different. I'll start with the article, but what I'm going to say is somewhat related to it, to give as a background. I've grown increasingly disappointed, not only with the press, but the average American. The press, in the sense of, for example, even if you watch ABC or NBC or CBS or look at the Washington Post, you probably haven't heard that in addition to this surge that we're having in Iraq, what's happened is a tremendous displacement of people. Now, we've already talked about the displacement of Christians, but what you probably haven't heard is that the various groups, the Sunnis and the Shiites, are really segregating themselves. Before the surge occurred, they were leaving each other's neighborhoods. In other words, in a Shiite neighborhood, you would have some Sunnis and vice versa, at 50,000 a month. After the surge, which is being proclaimed as big success, the rate of departure is 100,000 a month. I mean, that's a staggering figure of Sunnis leaving Shiite neighborhoods and Shiites leaving Sunni neighborhoods. Secondly, the Kurdish leader, and they're always pointing to the Kurds as very independent, you know, and very successful and so forth. You probably haven't heard ABC tell you that recently a Kurdish leader said, quote, centralized government in Iraq is finished. I mean, it's just finished. And, you know, that would call for a federal system and a weak central government and so on. You probably know that the British are slowly, somewhat quietly, moving out of Basra. What the press probably hasn't told you, and you're probably unaware of, is that the Muqtada al-Sadr's forces have moved in, and Maliki says, I can't control them. And so here we have a little glimpse at what will happen when we do the same thing.
And, of course, this is the Mahdi's army, which we have actually allowed a private a Shia army to exist there and function, and we've allowed it there for almost 4 years. Why, if you were trying to subdue a country, would you allow somebody who hates America to have a private army? I never have understood that.
Like I've said to your listeners many times, when something doesn't make sense, then look at it from the perspective of the power lead, and you'll all of a sudden dawn on you how it really does make sense.
If it doesn't make sense, there's got to be another explanation, and those are the explanations that we never think about. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and those of you who listen regularly know that he certainly is a world-famous researcher, has a tremendous amount of information, And you can get his articles at newswithviews.com. That's www.newswithviews.com. Or simply Google in Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Anyway, Dr. Cuddy is simply talking about what's going on over in Iraq and how, of course, since the surge, why the Shias and the Sunnis begin to segregate themselves totally, because no Sunni is safe in a Shia area, and no Shia is safe in a Sunni area. The Christians, of course, are being systematically slaughtered and driven out of the country thanks to the American invasion. And, of course, the Kurds there, recently a Kurdish leader said, this idea of a strong federal government is just all over, and we're not going to have a highly centralized government such as exists. This is finished. So pick up the story there.
Okay. I want to get to the article, but once again, I'm going to digress, and your listeners may say, well, what's he doing that for? But there's a definite connection here, and I had said just before the break that I'm growing increasingly, if it's possible, disappointed with the press, but also the average American, and I'm going to go back many, many years briefly. Back in the 30s and 40s, when film was in its infancy in terms of the American public going to theater, silent films were into the late 20s, and then you started to have the talkies. So in the 30s and 40s, it was a relatively new thing. And even then, and even if you would look at some B-Westerns, as they call them, you know, the Hopalong Cassidy types, which you can still see on video today, they would have very, very intricate plots. And the average person, the average American, was fine with that. They could follow it, you know, and they might have a plot about espionage and some double agent and so forth. And the American public, you know, your average Joe and Jane Doe and their little 10-year-old Johnny, they could all follow that. And, you know, they would look at it intelligently. There seemed to be some, you know, modicum of intelligence. Now, recently, we've talked, and many people have talked about the dumbing down of Americans. And it's true, but it's actually reached sort of a shocking level. And I remember first seeing how bad it was with regard to 9/11, and that's part of this article, the 9/11 anniversary. We're coming up on the 6th anniversary, and then I'm looking at the Iraq War and also the role of Pakistan.
Hold that thought for a bit. I can just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and of course we're talking about what's really going on, the fact that the American people don't seem to be able to think effectively about what's going on. They take everything they're told by the mass media. The mass media is being used to condition our minds. You know, all we have to do is see how they're using the mass media to get us to conserve. Everything is conservation. We're running out of energy. Conservation, we have to conserve. We have to conserve electricity. We have to conserve water. And, of course, global warming is going to certainly destroy our society. And the same thing is true with what's going on over in Iraq. Everything is colored in the light of what they want us to believe. That has very little to do with reality. They tell us the surge is working, and the generals will tell you it's not working. They'll tell you we're winning the war, and yet, of course, more and more people are dying over there all the time. They say if we pull out, there'll be chaos. But there is chaos there now, and the British are pulling out. They want to get their troops out, and as soon as they began to pull their troops out of Basra this last few days, why, of course, the Mahdi's army moved in. A private army, which has been permitted for 4 years by the United States. Why would you permit a private army run by this man, Sater, who hates America? Why would you allow that? Doesn't make sense. And then why are you arming the Sunnis who've been killing the Americans recently? And there's so many things over there that just don't make sense. And why aren't you protecting the Christians who are being literally driven out of the country where they've lived? 10% of the population used to be Christian, and now it's down to 2 or 3%. We've done a great job there if you wanted to destroy the Christian population of Iraq. So pick up this story there, Dennis.
Okay. Where I'd left off was this extreme disappointment in the press, but even more so, and this, I guess, gets to the heart of it, in the average American who seems to be nowhere nearly as intelligent or even competent or have the common sense of people in this country back in the 30s or 40s, when supposedly they were less educated, even though they weren't, but supposedly we're supposed to be more educated today and have this advanced technology and these degrees and more people getting their bachelor degrees and so forth and so on. But the fact of the matter sort of hit me. I had already known this before, but when the hearings were held and Condoleezza Rice, who was supposed to be in charge of our national security, was sitting there and they were asking her about 9/11, and she kept using that term, there was no actionable intelligence. And I immediately sort of looked at the camera and said, okay, you know, I'm expecting this the next 9/11 commission member to ask Dr. Rice, but wait a minute, let's stop for a minute. I want to make sure I got this right. You mean unless somebody calls you up and says, you know, we've got information that in a particular subway in Chicago on a particular date or whatever, you're going to sit there and twiddle your thumbs? Dr. Rice, have you never heard of contingency plans? And I kept expecting it. Well, the next commissioner will ask. Or no, well, the next one will ask. Well, surely somebody in the press will ask. And it went on, and nobody ever asked this woman that question. And apparently the American public was just sort of staring at the screen and not saying, wait a minute, let me pick up the phone and call my congressman. You know, somebody's got to ask her about this because this person's supposed to be in charge of my security here. But, you know, they never did. And so bringing it up to date, in terms of Iraq, I've been critical of George Bush in his lack of planning and so on, and I'll do it again. But I'm going to touch on the Democrats as well before I start this article, and specifically about the American public, because that's really bothering me. I mean, I knew they were dumbed down, but this is getting extremely bad. When George Bush became president, he didn't have that much knowledge. He was tutored by the Vulcans, as they're called. George Shultz, Condoleezza Rice, and others to try to get him up to speed on foreign policy, which they never did. And lo and behold, he becomes president, and we have 9/11, and then in 2003 goes Iraq. Okay, now it's 2004. Now, that's the next chance, really, for the American public to see him out there amongst the people, you know, handshaking in Iowa and, you know, wherever. Same thing now, same thing. The American public has this opportunity to ask now, just as they did then, certain basic questions, such as in 2004, Mr. Bush, you know, did you have any contingency plan for if the Sunnis and Shiites decided to start killing each other or something? And the press didn't seem to ask it. Same thing today. What you hear is the usual message by President Bush. He goes to this very isolated, you know, place out in the middle of nowhere and walks around like it's safe and it's not reflective of anything. But I want to pay particular attention, since I've devoted a lot of criticism to his lack of knowledge and planning and contingency planning, to the Democrats. I'm constantly amazed at watching these people, and they're out there on the stump. You know, there's Hillary and there's Barack Obama and so forth, and I can go on and on and on about the problems with the Iraq War, but let's just, in case one of these Democrats becomes president, I would think it'd be really interesting and important for somebody, the press, or some American out there, you know, shaking hands to say, okay, Mrs. Clinton, now your position is what? We withdraw to these bases, okay, all right, and then let's say a bloodbath does occur. What do you do next? Apparently this doesn't cross the American public's mind. I'm not saying, you know, we need to stay there forever. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I'd be mildly interested to hear if they, as well as President Bush or any Republican candidate, has thought through any contingencies if what they propose turns out to be a disaster. Has anybody asked Barack Obama, well, what do you want to do is, let's say, within a certain length of time, withdraw everybody? Okay, I understand that. Okay, now let's. What would you do if X happens or Y happens or Z happens? We don't seem to get there. I mean, you don't hear, you know, Brian Williams of NBC or Katie Couric or somebody saying, just a minute, Senator Obama, I'd like to go down this road. You know, let's think this thing through logically. You opposed the war in Iraq. Okay, got that. Okay, now let's see what happens if Iran tries to move in. Let's say they do establish some al-Qaeda base. in Iraq in a Sunni area, you know, what would you do? I mean, I'd just be interested, you know, to hear their response. I may like it, I may not, but I'd at least like somebody to ask the question. Apparently, they don't want to. They're oblivious, and the American public is just sitting there, you know, with their hot dogs in their mouth, nodding their head up and down and letting them get away with this. And that's really disturbing, that the American public today doesn't have the common sense that the American public did back in the 30s and 40s and even 50s. And so we've been dumbed down, and we're apparently just dissatisfied with that. We're satisfied with not asking the most simple questions to find out what these people who are going to control our future have in store for us. Are they prepared? Yep. Do they have contingency plans, you know, for an economic disaster? I mean, did somebody anticipate this mortgage problem going astray? I mean, hopefully it wouldn't, but just in case it did somebody sort of plan for this? We don't hear them asking that.
And, of course, the thing is that, you know, certainly nobody, after we'd won the war, things were fine. We controlled Iraq, and certainly by the 1st of May 2003, the Americans were in total control, and then in comes Paul Bremer, who immediately disbands the Iraqi army over the objection of the American generals and disbands the police force over the objection of the American generals and disbands the Iraqi civil service, and that by so doing cuts off electricity and water and sewage, you know, to the Iraqi people over the objections of the American generals. And then they saw, oh, shucks, but we had no idea what was going to happen. What would happen if you did that in New York City? I mean, anybody would suggest that nothing would happen, you could get by without all that in an organized society, would be laughed out, and yet nobody's critical of Paul Bremer. Nobody asks why we did what we're doing. These are brilliant people. Bremer is one of the smartest people in the world. In fact, I have a book about running the world, and Bremer is one of the stars in this book, written by a man associated with this very powerful group of elitists, you know, who run the National Security Council. Most of them come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And these people have made contingency plans for everything. So why would they do something that stupid unintentionally unless they knew it was going to happen and they wanted chaos so they could justify staying there for four long, bloody years? And now, of course, what are we going to do? Why, my goodness, if we pull out, there'll be chaos. And yet, of course, there's chaos. Millions of people have fled the country. I mean, hundreds of thousands have been killed and slaughtered, and they're dying of disease, and the children are dying over there at a phenomenal rate because of hydration, and the whole medical system is broken down. How could our leaders have been that ignorant, that, or did they have a contingency plan, or have things gone exactly as they intended? That would be the question I would ask.
Right, and we have the American public has allowed them to get away with these things, and a lot of mistakes that, as you said, appear not to be logical. I would still, in addition to the Republicans, like to hear. Let's say one of your listeners is opposed to the Iraq War. Okay, fine. Let's say one of your listeners is thinks we should withdraw immediately, start withdrawing in 6 months. The position, I think, of Bill Richardson or one of the leading Democratic candidates. Okay, fine. I'd at least like Richardson or Obama or Hillary or whoever to have somebody ask them, okay, fine, let's go down the road and say, what if? You know, what if you withdraw? What if whatever, everything goes fine? Great, no problem. But what if Al-Qaeda establishes a base and does such and such? What would you do? I'd just like to hear their response. I'd be curious, you know, since apparently, you know, things like this are in our future and can affect us. And I may like it, I may not. But at least we'd know what their thinking is, if they have these plans laid out so that hopefully we have some, you know, responsible response to whatever happens.
Well, because they're going to tell you, well, we're just going to turn over the responsibility to the Iraqis. We're going to let the Iraqi army run things and the Iraqi government run things. And of course, we're going to just let them happen. And then, of course, we suddenly say, we don't like the way the Iraqi government's doing things. We're going to have to replace the duly elected government of Iraq. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, Dr. Cuddy, you picked this story up there.
Okay. What you said before the just before the break. Let's assume that happens. Let's say they we withdraw in 6 months, and well, we don't like what they're doing, so we're going to have to replace the duly elected Iraqi government. Okay, fine. Then ask them the next question. Well, isn't this a democratic government that you installed, and how can you intervene and replace a duly elected? I mean, you know, at least ask that question. Or how would you replace them? Would you send troops back in? Would it be a little invasion? Would it be a big invasion? at least these people would be on the record for having been asked that. But apparently, you know, the press and the American public, given this chance, this is one of the few opportunities where the American people can come face-to-face with these candidates and at these, you know, public forums or whatever, town hall meetings, ask them these things. But apparently it's not going to happen. The American public, I think, went too much fluoride or something in the water. They just, you know, are mind-numbed or whatever. Okay, well, anyway, the article that I did this time is titled The 9/11 Anniversary, Pakistan and Iraq. And I'd say that both of these things are occurring at about the same time, the 9/11 anniversary and General Petraeus' report will be roughly about the same, within a few days apart. And I also put in here Pakistan's connection to terrorism, because they've played a role which apparently the Bush administration hasn't wanted to make waves on.
But I think it's so important, Dr. Cuddy, that people understand that, of course, the Pakistani government has been financing al-Qaeda, and they've been financing the Taliban, and we've been financing the Pakistani government. Now, why would we be funding a government that's funding the people who are killing our boys in the poppy fields and the villages of Afghanistan? That just doesn't make sense.
No, and there are certain elements of this that most Americans don't know, because the press isn't going to tell them. What you probably have heard is that Osama bin Laden was behind 9/11. And, well, how did he do it? Lots of money. Okay, he's inherited a lot of money from his folks, his father and his big construction company, something like that. Well, that's the general story, and that's what most people have heard. However, if you dig a little, what you find is that this operation had a lot of, you know, fake passports and a lot of things that is really hard to do from a cave in Afghanistan. And so there is a really strong indication that some government had to be helpful, at least some element of some government, as in Pakistan and primarily the ISI, their intelligence service. And you probably, as I said, have heard that Osama bin Laden had these hundreds of millions of dollars, and so, you know, he shared this money with these members of al-Qaeda, and they came over here, and so forth and so on. Well, actually, that didn't really happen. What you find out is that the funding for 9/11 primarily came from certain elements in Pakistan, not so much from Osama, because remember, he's now, I mean, at the time, he was in in Afghanistan hiding out. No, it came from in Pakistan is where a lot of the funds for this came. So anyway, I've mentioned before about how the head of the Pakistan's intelligence service, General Mahmoud Ahmad, had the $100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta not too long before the attack.
Hold that thought. Dr. Cuddy will be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the point that Dr. Cuddy is making is that certainly the 9/11 attack never could have happened. And never could have happened without help from some government intelligence service. And certainly one of those countries would be Pakistan. And Pakistan had a very efficient government intelligence service. They would have the capacity to have arranged for this sophisticated attack. Think how those buildings came down in perfect symmetry. They had gone from one side to the other. Either one of them had tipped at any point where they could have certainly... But they didn't tip to either side. Perfectly symmetrical descent at the speed of gravity. Now, this takes a very, very sophisticated demolition of those buildings. Building number 7 at 5:20 in the afternoon. And Osama bin Laden did not have that money or wherewithal to have planned that. It had to be an intelligence program of some nation, and Pakistan certainly had a very, very efficient intelligence organization. In fact, Dr. Cuddy is pointing out that the General Mahmoud Ahmad, who was the head of the ISI, had actually wired $100,000 to a man named Muhammad Atta about a month before that, and you can actually Google that in on the internet, Mahmoud Ahmad, $100,000, Muhammad Atta, and you'll find that the story is well known to everybody but the American people, because the American media doesn't want people to begin looking behind the story we've been told as to who was really behind what happened that day. So pick the story up there, Dennis.
Okay, and I've also mentioned previously about the closeness of our CIA to the ISI. In fact, most of our covert operations over the past 10, 20 years in that part of the world against, you know, the Soviets some years ago, for example, were run through the ISI. Now, the $100,000 that General Ahmad had wired was actually sent just after August 11th, you know, about a month before the attack, by a fellow named Saeed Sheikh. And I use one quote, just there's a lot of stuff, but I use a quote by the Pittsburgh Tribune Review on March 3rd of 2002, you know, about 6 months after the attack. And in there, the quote is, quote, there are many in Musharraf, he's the head of Pakistan, still now, he was then, the Musharraf's government, who believe that Saeed Sheikh's power comes not from the ISI, but from his connections with our own CIA. The theory is that Saeed Sheikh was bought and paid for, end quote. So this gives some small indication of how very, very closely these two entities work together, the CIA and the ISI. Now, the Al-Qaeda member who is the mastermind, they say, of the planning of 9/11 wasn't Osama. You know, he's dragging his dialysis machine around. The mastermind of 9/11 was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who actually went to school in, down the road from me here.
Yeah, and, he went to school right there in North Carolina.
Yeah, he did.
And, but of course, isn't it amazing we just never mentioned that this man is this wicked Islamic terrorist was trained right here in the United States? And you know what's even more interesting is the part that Richard Pearl, remember reporter who was executed, wasn't he trying to look into some of these things, the relationship between, between the Pakistani intelligence and what happened? What was that all about?
That's where he got in trouble. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the mastermind of the 9/11 attack, of that supposed Richard Reed shoe bomb attempt, although that was, as Dr. Stans mentioned, rather screwy. And along with Saeed Sheikh, both of them, the kidnapping of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, who was over there at the time. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was also connected to the ISI, and so was Saeed Sheikh, both of them, very, very close to the ISI. Well, what happened with Pearl was in early January of 2002, the first thing he started investigating was this shoe bomber, Richard Reed. He started looking at it, he read a little story about it, said, that sounds interesting. And so he starts probing a little bit. And what happened was a newspaper over there, the Gulf News, about 6 months after the 9/11 attack, said Pearl also may have been looking into the U.S. training and backing of the ISI. So he was starting to look into that connection, you know, the CIA. And that training and backing actually, in fact, began way back in the mid-'80s, in March of 85. And the CIA and ISI actually funded those new madrasas in Pakistan, which taught jihad against the Soviets, you know, the ones that we supported with those textbooks telling them to go to war.
Well, what Dr. Cuddy's really pointing out is that all of these schools, these radical Islamic schools for the youth over there in Afghanistan and Pakistan, were financed, of course, in large part by the intelligence agencies,
right,
and by the USAID, United States Agency for International Development. Why would we be indoctrinating the Islamic youth with this radical form of Islam that had very little influence before it began to be backed with your tax money? The rebirth of radical Islam, and now we'd have an enemy that we could go to war with. Well, Dr. Stan, go right ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay. Now, this is back in the 80s, and the CIA and ISI are funding these new schools, madrasas, in Pakistan, which are teaching, you know, jihad. And it's a sort of a collection here of people are drawn to it, you know, and this is part of Brzezinski's, you know, pan-Islamic movement against the Soviets to serve as a southern border. You know, we've been through all that before. Well, anyway, what happens is one of the strategies that I'm sure will shock your listeners is that the CIA had some connection with the drug trade, you remember, like in Vietnam. Well, what they found is that the ISI said, you know, we can make our own money here, sort of like the Knights Templar, we can become independent ourselves. And so they were, you know, running heroin up to get the Soviet troops hooked on heroin, you know, as part of the grand plan, the strategy there. And all of a sudden, the ISI guys, I mean, they started making tons of money through this this drug trade. And so, in fact, in case you think this is just some rumor, you know, somebody's cockamamie idea, on November 29th of 1999, the UN Drug Control Program reported that the ISI makes about $2.5 billion annually from illegal drug sales. So, it's common knowledge. The ISI is into these drug sales. They're making a ton of money from which they can conduct their own operations. And on September 27th of 2001, you know, shortly after 9/11, a newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, revealed that, quote, opium cultivation and heroin production in Pakistan's northern tribal belt adjoining Afghanistan were a vital offshoot of the ISI-CIA cooperation. Heroin sales in the U.S., in the U.S., carried out through an elaborate web of deception, transport networks, couriers, and payoffs, offset the cost of the decade-long war in Afghanistan, end quote. Now, remember, he's not just talking about the Soviets getting them hooked. This is talking about heroin sales in the U.S. So that was the end of the quote. And my next statement is the ISI created the Taliban in Afghanistan in September of 94. That's about 10 years into this period after this cooperation beginning in March of 1985. Okay, back to Daniel Pearl. Pearl was kidnapped on January 23 of 2002, and, you know, they were looking and looking. They finally confirmed that he had been murdered on February 22nd of that year. So this is early in 2002. All right. Interestingly, the American press hasn't pursued Pearl's investigation. I mean, you would think, wow, you know, this guy's really onto something. But they haven't seemed interested in pursuing the investigation of the connection between the ISI. And remember, the ISI is helping Al-Qaeda. They helped Osama bin Laden get medical treatment at Rawalpindi.
Hold up right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And we were talking about the fact that it was the ISI, Pakistani Intelligence, which has always worked very closely with the CIA, that created this whole Taliban movement in 1994, about 13 or 14 years. after the United States government had begun recruiting Muslim warriors throughout the world who became the Mujahideen, who defeated the Soviets in Afghanistan, and eventually that war ended in 1988. I think the Soviets left in 1989. But, you know, after that, of course, and why in 1994, the ISI, which has always been an extension of the CIA, then goes ahead, creates the Taliban, and now we have this this movement there, this radical Islamic movement, the CIA and USAID, United States Agency for International Development, are actively funding the madras schools. These are the radical Islamic schools, both in Afghanistan, but primarily in Pakistan, where these young people, young impressionable people, are being indoctrinated in this radical form of Islam. And anybody who doubts that, we have a wonderful article we sent out from the Washington Post about the ABCs of jihad and how we spent $51 or $52 million on these Islamic textbooks to be used in these radical schools to indoctrinate the youth and create this Islamic movement, which now threatens to destabilize all of Pakistan. In fact, all of the Middle East, and you have to ask yourself, why would you do anything that foolish? Are you trying to create an enemy so we can have a war over there? Would there be that long-term planning? If you want to have a war, you got to have an enemy that hates you, and then you got to get the American people to hate the Muslims by indoctrinating them in how the terrible the Muslims are, and teaching them all about the ancient history of the Muslim faith. And you look back 10 years, how many people in America 10 years ago were ready to launch a massive war on the Muslim world? How many people are willing to do that today? And some of our Christian leaders are openly advocating that we've just got to bomb Iran, and we've got to do it just as soon as possible, and plunge the whole of the Middle East into a fiery holocaust. Go right ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay. The basic point about, once you find out that Daniel Pearl has been murdered, you would think the American press, oh, well, they can't do that to one of our own fellow journalists. We're going to, you know, get to the bottom of this, sort of like Watergate, right? But they haven't. They haven't tried to see what follow through with his investigation of the connection between the ISI, and we know they helped Osama get his medical treatment in Rawalpindi, they haven't investigated the connection between them and the CIA. And remember, just like the Pakistani ISI helped medical treatment, the CIA operative earlier had met bin Laden in a Dubai hospital. You know, went up to the second floor, had a chat with him where he was being treated at that time.
Now, wait a minute. That was in July of the year 2001, about 2 months before the attack on the World Trade Center.
Right.
You can Google that in. You know, Osama bin Laden, Dubai, dialysis, 2001, and it's up there. We have the articles, but go ahead.
And then 2 months later, the day before 9/11, he's getting the, you know, same medical treatment in Rawalpindi with the help of the ISI. He periodically has to do this, right? That's sort of hard to do from a cave in Afghanistan. So anyway, the American public didn't seem interested in looking at that. Nor have they seemed interested in investigating the connection between 9/11 mastermind Mohammed, K.S. Mohammed, and the ISI, or ISI radicals' facilitation of Osama's and al-Qaeda's escape from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Remember when we launched our attack? Oh, my goodness, look, they just slipped by, you know, Tora Bora, and out they went.
You know, one of the things that really entertains me most, you know, Dennis, if it had not been for John Reed, who supposedly was trying to light the C4 in his shoes, you know, and explode the plane.
Richard Reed.
Right, but the thing is, of course, you really can't set that off. You can burn C4. You can't set it off by having a fuse. But because of that instance, now when we go to the airport, everybody has to take off their shoes. Because of what I believe, of course, was a staged situation. I think Reed was not very smart. I think he was used in this whole thing. But millions of people have to take off their shoes every day to get on a plane because of Reed, who, if you know anything at all about explosives, he never could have ignited those the bombs in his shoes by lighting a fuse. We go right ahead.
Right, including the little 90-year-old lady. She's got to take her shoes off, too, while the, you know, no more than two Muslim-looking people can be, oh, my, you know, there's a third one. No, we can't question him. Let's go get the little 90-year-old lady.
You're talking about we can't do racial
right.
profiling. We're at war with terrorism. The lives of every American is threatened. But we can't do racial profiling or close our borders. Or have armed marshals on every plane, and we certainly can't have armed pilots, because of course that might offend the Osama bin Laden or something. Go right ahead.
Okay, so the American press didn't seem interested in the connection between the CIA and ISI, or KS Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the ISI, or how the ISI helped Osama and Al Qaeda just happen to escape through Tora Bora. They don't seem to be interested in doing any of that, and you would think that would sort of be important. Given that recently Richard Haass said, yeah, Pakistan is the head of the CFR, president of the CFR, said, yes, Pakistan is the key today. You know, that's the most important place. Okay, fine. If it is, what happens if Musharraf is bumped off by one of these ISI radicals and therefore al-Qaeda or the radical elements there now have nuclear weapons? I mean, you'd think that'd be something the press would sort of be mildly interested in investigating, but nope, they don't want to get into that.
And first, apparently, if we're to believe anything we're told, that Pakistan probably has at least 100 nuclear weapons. It has sophisticated missiles that it got from Communist China using American technology that we gave to Communist China because Bill Clinton wanted a campaign contribution. If you believe that story, you believe anything. But, of course, this is a very real possibility that what we would do if we were to attack Iran, we would provoke perhaps a revolution in Pakistan, and the radical Islamists, many of them, of course, trained with the textbooks that we sent to Afghanistan back in the late 1980s and 1990s. Those people now in the military would, of course, seize the government, turn it over to the radical Islamists, and now the followers of Osama bin Laden, the wicked Osama bin Laden, would have nuclear weapons and very, very sophisticated missiles made with American technology. Pick the story up.
And if something like that happened, golly shucks, we might have to attack them too. And Iran.
Obama has actually suggested that we may very well have to attack Pakistan.
Right. That is after we completely withdraw from Iraq.
Right.
Right. Okay, likewise, the press doesn't seem to be interested in how 9/11 could have been easily prevented. Now, the reason they would be interested is in case a similar attack occurred. And I'm not going to, you know, get into that. You can look at the article. I just go back a little bit talking about the solution that I said was obvious to me. You'd simply have an Apache Longbow helicopter on standby alert once you had that August 6th. A presidential daily briefing. You say, well, where might the attack? World Trade Center. They already tried to bomb it, blow it up in 93. Well, you know, what if there's a sarin gas attack, you know, a truck bomb? And what if there's an air attack? It seemed rather simple to me. But the press doesn't seem to be interested in that as well. Now, the second subject I'm taking up here is the issue of Iraq. And they still don't seem to get it. What happens is they'll go over there and they'll interview, or they'll be waiting breathlessly for General David Petraeus's report. And what's going to happen? It'll come out. It'll have some mixed results. It'll say, okay, in this province we're doing better, and, you know, we wish they would do more politically to ameliorate the differences, blah, blah, blah. You know, all of this bureaucratic speak.
But do you think any American would honestly believe that Dr. Petraeus, and some people do refer to him not as Petraeus, but Petraeus with a B, but that he will actually, as a military general, would actually speak out and say what he really believes? He is told what to say. The military, of course, is instructed what they're to do. If they're told a lie, they lie. And that's the way the military works today. And if you want to maintain your career, you want to maintain your power base, you do what you're told. And although there may be a little bit of criticism there, I suspect that General Petraeus will back the president. We've just got to keep on doing what we're doing, because if we pull out, there's going to be chaos over there, and people are going to die.
Right. And what, I mean, even if he says, comes back and says, well, yeah, there's this progress in this particular area. You had a surge there, right? Uh-huh, yeah. Okay, well, my immediate question, which apparently the American public and the press doesn't pursue, is, well, I guess if you concentrate enough police, let's say, in a particular suburb of Los Angeles, it's going to be sort of nice there for a while. You can look and showcase, say, wow, look at the great drop in crime rate in this particular suburb of Los Angeles. Well, the point is, it has never been about whether you can bring security to a particular or two or three particular locations. The problem right from the beginning was that you never had enough troops to secure the whole country simultaneously, and therefore, as it's been called, it's just a whack-a-mole process that you're getting into. You whack them down in this particular area, Anbar province or wherever, and then, you know, they'll move somewhere else, or they'll, you know, adopt a different tactic or whatever. So the fact that you can show, or he will show, and I'm sure he will, that there's, quote, progress in certain areas is meaningless, actually, because you never have, and they're never going to put enough troops in there to replicate this in every single area of Iraq.
And, of course, if they'd wanted to do the right thing, they would have put enough troops in.
Right.
At the very beginning, they never wanted a solution. We were never there to win. We were there simply to fight war, and we're not going to pull our troops out. I mean, we're going to keep some troops there in the green zone. That's why they built this massive installation over there. We still have our troops in Germany. 60 years after the Second World War ended. We still have our troops stationed in Japan 60 years after the Second World War ended. We still have our troops in South Korea 50 years after the Korean War ended. Do you really think we're going to pull our troops out? And if you do, why are they built the largest, embassy anywhere in the entire world at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars right there in Baghdad if we're just going to pull our troops out?
No, and that includes Hillary or Barack Obama. They're not going to do it either, but the press doesn't go down that line and ask them, okay, you're going to do this, okay, what if, and are you going to do that? Are you going to totally withdraw? And, they really don't pursue that. And so Senator John Warner from Virginia has said that he's not going to run again, and so I guess that's why he's speaking frankly about 10 days ago. He said, quote, American soldiers are now fighting for a failing government more interested in narrow sectarian interest, end quote. Well, at least somebody's saying that. Years ago I said that the primary problem here is a rather intractable problem. Is because once you say we're going to have a democratic government, and here's their constitution, and once you look at the constitution, and it has all these freedoms, but at the end of each little, you have freedom of speech, it says except as provided for by law, and then you look at the beginning and say, well, what kind of law are they talking about? And they're talking about Islamic law. Well, then it's not just a religious difference between Sunnis and Shiites, it also becomes a legal difference. The Shiites, as the majority, can say, okay, this is going to be Islamic law, and it's going to be our interpretation of Sharia or Islamic law, because it's written into the Constitution. We have to enforce this religious law and our own interpretation of it on you Sunnis. So it's not just a religious difference they're fighting over, it's a legal difference.
And you know, I think what is so interesting is that now we're hearing people say, well, Malachi's going to have to be, he's going to have to be removed, he's not doing a good job. Well, wait a minute. He was democratically elected. I mean, everybody knows he was democratically elected. We saw those women with the black shawl holding up their finger covered with ink. If he was democratically elected, how could the American government go in and replace him? I haven't quite figured that out yet. Or maybe all of this is simply a charade to convince the American people that our leaders really believe in democracy. Whatever that means. I know the founding fathers of America hated the idea. You read the 10th of the Federalist Papers and read what Madison said about democracy. He reflected what all of our founding fathers knew and believed because they had studied history. Democracies never work. They're usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. And that is what James Madison said, not what I say. The 10th of the Federalist Papers, read what Madison said. And understand, it's all a charade. We're not backing democracy there. If we were there, why? If we really did, why did we build the largest military installation anywhere there in the world in Baghdad, unless we were planning on staying? And how can they have a true democracy if they're occupied by American troops indefinitely?
And Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, of course, is a Shiite, the majority government. And he knows that. I mean, he knows what you're saying. And so just a few days ago, about 7 days ago, on August 26th, when Senators Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin were talking about, we're very dissatisfied and so forth, Maliki said he wants them, Hillary Clinton, Carl Levin, and others, to, quote, come to their senses and stop treating Iraq like one of their villages. You know, it's a little hint there at Hillary's, it takes a village, end quote. And shortly before that, he said he didn't have to abide by any American timetable for progress because he knows that. I mean, he knows we've been over here saying, yes, a democratic government, yeah, you're in charge, yes, you have a constitution. He knows, what are we going to do? Are we going to depose him? I mean, are we? That'd be a good question to ask.
Well, maybe he would end up like Mr. Nguyen and Mr. Diem over in Vietnam when they crossed us, and of course they were both assassinated. And, of course, we have assassinated Patrice Lumumba and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. And if you read, of course, John Perkins' book, he will tell you about how we killed the leader of El Salvador, how we assassinated the leader, of Panama when he was involved with that. And remember what happened to John Kennedy when he fell out of favor with the elite. Not only was he assassinated, but his assassin was immediately assassinated. What a coincidence. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very funny. I mean, and didn't he, Ruby, actually die about a year later of some sort of mysterious internal cancer that he just happened to get while in prison?
He got it suddenly, about just a few days after he told the members of the Warren Commission to tell him the truth if they just get him out of Dallas. And he suddenly developed a fulminant cancer and died in 3 or 4 days. I mean, it was the most amazing thing. And you could actually go down to Dallas, see the pictures there, the video of Ruby saying, "Get me out of here, and I'll tell you exactly what happened." He looked awfully healthy that day, but a few days later, he was terminal cancer. Go right ahead, Dr. Cuddy. Our guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and I hope any of you want to get copies of the tapes of this program, because, of course, we talk during the breaks as well. And Dr. Cuddy is a phenomenal source of information. Go to his website, newswithviews.com, pull out all of his articles, read them, study them. If you really want to understand what's going on, there's no better source of information. And, of course, Dr. Cuddy asks the questions nobody else wants to. Why don't they make any contingency plans? Is there incapable of it? Or are we really following our master plan they don't want the American people to know about? Well, Dr. Cuddy, we've got 3 minutes to close up.
Okay. And in case, I guess a lot of the attention or anti-Iraq has been on the Democrats, but like I said, Senator John Warner, a Republican, has talked about we're now fighting for this failing government over there. And another formerly loyal supporter, Senator Mitch McConnell, at the same time, August 26th, said that what we have is an Iraq government which has not passed an oil law. That's the key, you know, money provision, sharing the profits between among the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds. They haven't done that. We've been there 4 years or so, at least 4 years. Number two, this Iraq government has not completed this de-Ba'athification process. They're infiltrated to the hilt and the police and the military. And it also hasn't even held local elections. So here we're talking about a Democratic government. Now, you would think if you really had a Democratic government, and we're 4 years into this thing, you might have some local elections, but they haven't even had those. I mean, that's how insecure this, quote, Democratic government really is. And so the last question I raise is perhaps we should have paid a little more attention when we put our imprimatur on Maliki to the fact that when Saddam was in charge of Iraq, and Maliki fell out of favor. Where did he go for exile? Did he go to London, Switzerland, Paris? No. He spent his exile in Iran and Syria. And Maliki's constitutional mandate is to last till 2010. So unless something happens to him, this guy's there 3 more years, and he's buddies with the Iranians and the Syrians. So you got to ask yourself, why would we put our blessing upon this fellow?
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions there. And of course, these questions are not going to be asked by the controlled media. They're simply going to go along and talk about all sorts of unimportant things. But, of course, the really important things that will determine what sort of a future there's going to be in the Middle East, or whether we're going to go to war with Iran, how soon we're going to go to war with Iran, what will happen if the entire Islamic world rises up against America and decides to strike our country and collapse our economy, and certainly if some of the other countries holding massive amounts of American currency were to dump it on the market, America today is borrowing between $2.5 to $3.5 billion every day to pay our debts. And if they collapse our economy, what do you think would happen to America? Well, what happened to you out there in the listening audience? Well, Dr. Cuddy, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
God bless, and of course, we'll look forward to having you with us again next week.
Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Dr. Dennis Cuddy. I hope you enjoyed our program. I know I always do. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, I hope you enjoyed our program with Dr. Cuddy. I know I always do. And if you'd like to get his books, we carry out the Conspiracy, Secret Records Revealed, one little tiny book, but it's well worthwhile reading. And then we carry his book on mental health screening. We carry his book on the road to socialism, his book on the Education and the Timeline for the New World Order. Anyway, they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you want, of course, to really understand what's going on, let me suggest the three pamphlets we put together. They're called Foreknowledge 911, made up of about 15 of my newsletters. You can read, of course, to really understand what happened. I suggest you read my August, September, October, November, and December newsletters for the year 2006. They're up on the Internet, or they're up on News with Views. At least the first several of them are. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the little pamphlet we put out, most recently, the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. I mean, where did communism get its funding? Because communism doesn't work. How were the communists, which are really have always had a backward economy, able to become the largest producers of oil and natural gas in the world and build all these wonderful, great big pipelines that allow them to really begin to dominate Europe, Eastern Europe, you know, with their gas and natural oil shipments? Well, it was all built by America. And that's in the Communist Capitalist Alliance. You can pull them down on our webpage at RadioLiberty.com, the March, April, May, and June newsletters. You get them in pamphlet form and get multiple ones if you want to for distribution very economically, because you've got to get people out there educated. We can only reach a certain number of people. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our number 1-800-544-8927. Let me remind you about the Radio Liberty Annual Seminar, October 28th. That's just a little less than 2 months from now. It's the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be all day long. Lunch will be served. If you're coming from outside the area, why, we will have rooms reserved until the 28th of September at a special rate. Hotel rooms, if you don't get in before then, why, are you going to have to pay the full tab? If you get in earlier, why, of course, they're much more economical. And, of course, you're going to have reservations because we're serving lunch. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the all-day seminar. Starts early in the morning, goes late, but you'll learn so much and get a chance to meet other people and get the information that you need to have to survive in times like these. We're entering very difficult times, as I mentioned. Right now, we're talking about going to war with Iran. Where's the money coming from? We're having to borrow between $2 and $3 billion a day, $2.5 to $3.5 billion every day on the international markets just to pay our debts, and no end in sight. And, of course, we're going to really blow up most of our cruise missiles and most of our Tomahawk missiles and drop most of our bombs and literally contaminate all of them. Iran with depleted uranium, and if you want to know about that, we have a wonderful video. It's called Beyond Treason. Beyond Treason, put out by Joyce Riley, that tells you about depleted uranium. It introduces the officers who've worked with it, who their health has been ruined. And it comes, the DVD comes with a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of government documents on the toxicity of depleted uranium. They know that we're poisoning the area, and we're poisoning our own soldiers. And when our boys come back from fighting over the Middle East today, within 3 months, 30% of them are ill. And the government says, oh, shucks, we have no idea why. Well, understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on the political and ideological battlefield. And we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but to pray for Radio Liberty. Because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization.